You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On the afternoon of Saturday, August 9th, 2014, Officer Darren Wilson of the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department shot and killed an 18-year-old black man named Michael Brown, and that led to some of the largest racially charged protests and riots in recent memory. Ferguson's former police chief, Thomas Jackson, has written Policing America, What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn from It, in which he describes the actions he took, his philosophy on policing, and the role of politics and optics in what happened in Ferguson. It's published by Skyhorse Publishing, and I'm pleased to welcome Thomas Jackson to our show. Hello. Are you there? Well, we're speaking to Thomas Jackson, or we're hoping to speak to him, from St. Louis, Missouri. Thomas Jackson, are you around?
I can hear you, but it's a little burbled.
Oh, well, should we take a little break and try to make get a better connection, or is it improving?
Well,
okay. I thought I'd start off with your thoughts about how the Charlottesville police handled the demonstrations this past weekend.
Not in the habit of criticizing other police departments without knowing what was going on internally, but I think it's unfortunate that the two groups, were able to meet in the street there and fight and do all the damage that was done because the real victims of that are the people that were killed and injured and people that lived there that had their town turned upside down.
There are photos of civilians who appear to be heavily armed in Charlottesville. Is that something that you could have dealt with as a public safety issue?
Well, as a matter of fact, we had that. That's not unusual in these things. We had that here in Ferguson. During our months of protest, we often had people show up openly carrying, and of course, we had gunfire on an almost nightly basis. As a matter of fact, the night of the Darren Wilson grand jury decision, the next day, we recovered more than 3,000 spent cartridges. So, the people showing up armed and look like they are aggressively armed is a problem. And it needs to be monitored closely by law enforcement.
You write that
whether lawful or not.
You write that when you first came on the job, many public apartment complexes were falling apart, largely ignored by landlords. What kind of work did you do to help make those neighborhoods more livable?
So what we did is, first thing, we put more patrols in there to reduce what we were having street robberies and shootings and things like that. So we increased the patrols with overtime. And then what we did is I got with our city manager and mayor and our city attorney, and we contacted the owners of the apartment complexes, not the managers, because the managers are owned by, the owners, what the owners would let them do. So we brought the owners, some from, the East Coast, we brought them into Ferguson, and we sat them down and we said, you would not live under these conditions, and our residents are not going to either. So we put very serious restrictions on their ability to rent apartments, and they had to comply with quality of life things. And it became a pretty successful public-private partnership, if you will. And then we had, one of the things they did was we had them put up cameras throughout the apartment complex and hire security. We had them issue parking passes for residents, remove derelict vehicles, clean up the property. And then, of course, these were legal binding documents that both parties signed. So, and in one of the apartment complexes, we had them put up a gated entrance, we had them do enhanced background investigations, and then verify that the people who were renting the apartment are actually the ones that moved in. Because there was one case in one of the apartment complexes where we had a shooting. And the witnesses and the people present at the shooting, there were six adult males who claimed a one-bedroom apartment as their primary residence.
Throughout the book, you write a lot about community policing. How does that work in a city where the majority of the population is black and the majority of the police force is white?
You just get out into the public. And you consider that Ferguson is like 6 square miles, 20,000 people. So we're not talking about a thriving metropolis. You know, we're talking about a small town. And we acted like a small town. So we had 9 neighborhood associations in that small town. And they had monthly meetings that could be attended by anybody. And I attended most of those meetings, but my community resource officer was always there. And I always had a commander there if I wasn't there. And the community resource officer would come with statistics for that particular neighborhood from the previous month, you know, crime statistics and other information related to the police department. And then other city heads would come, you know, most of the complaints you'd hear at those neighborhood meetings would be about potholes and streetlights, kids in the park after dark, you know, and speeding. So what we did, the biggest part of community policing, is to have access to face-to-face contact with the public, and so we did that. And we also had all kinds of activities in each one of the neighborhoods. We had each neighborhood had a neighborhood association. We would have a street fest where that neighborhood would be closed off, some streets closed off on a Sunday, and we'd have rides and, you know, climbing walls and health checks and, you know, just ponies and things like that, just a small carnival in the neighborhood. Of course, they're all open to the whole city, but we just moved it around to various neighborhoods.
Did you try to hire minority police officers?
Oh, it was a priority, and I did. But the problem in St. Louis County, when you look at how it's laid out, there's some 60 police departments in the region. So the smaller the police department, the harder it is to recruit, because the bigger police departments have detective bureaus that are big and canine and motorcycle and you could be a homicide detective or an undercover detective. You know, you had a much better chance at a bigger department to get into those things than a smaller one, where the opportunities for advancement are limited. But we contacted every academy class and tried to recruit out of the classes. We also did our own in the community recruiting. We paid, you know, for officers to go through the police academy. So, I actually promoted the first 2 ever African-American supervisors on the Ferguson Police Department while I was there. So the way it was painted is nothing like how it really was.
Well, you talk a lot about optics, but before we get to that, one big question many people had is, why was Michael Brown's body left untouched on the scene of the crime for 4 hours? Which really got a lot of people upset.
Oh yeah, it was a horrible thing to see, and I talk about that extensively in the book, and I talked about that in the press quite a lot, because it's not something that we wanted. What happened was I immediately turned the investigation, and therefore the crime scene investigation, over to the St. Louis County Police Department. Now, this was on a Saturday, so there was only one investigative unit on duty at the time, and they were just finishing up with the hostage situation on the far other side of the county, some 45 minutes away. So we called and requested that the county, I talked to the county chief, and he agreed they would do it. But it was, a full hour after that they arrived and then just began processing the scene. Another thing that happened during this was that near where the body was laying, shots started ringing out. Where 3 or 4 separate times when gunfire started coming out of the crowd. Well, that makes it an insecure crime scene, both for the detectives and for the public that's in the area. So we, each time that happened, we had to resecure, look for where the shots were coming from, and then make sure that the folks were safe and uninjured.
But didn't it take 40 minutes before the St. Louis Police Department was called? Why during that time was the body uncovered?
No. It wasn't 40 minutes before they were called. The shooting happened around noon, and I was contacted, minutes after that. Excuse me. And the moment I hung up from being notified, I called the St. Louis County Chief, and he agreed to take over the investigation. So that was within minutes that was turned over. Other things that happened were, the crime scene investigators my investigators were on the scene, and normally you would cover the body or put up barriers around it. Well, some activists in the crowd approached me and said, "You know, it looks like you're trying to conceal the body to plant a gun." Well, when I got there, which was 45 minutes later, you know, the body had been covered, and ultimately we did put up barriers around the body, and I had, you know, one of the older activists from the community just stand with me while the scene was processed.
I'm speaking with Thomas Jackson, the former police chief of Ferguson, Missouri. He's written a book called Policing America, What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn from It. You mentioned the optics. What were the optics in this situation?
There were several things. One of the things that stands out is during the riots, which were nightly, we had press that was portraying this as peaceful protesters and militarized police. And what we had was we had protests that went on pretty much all day, every day. And when the sun started to go down, it started to become violent. The rocks would start flying. They would start throwing urine at police officers, death threats, threats against our families. And then the gunfire would start. And then the SWAT teams would come in, and we would disperse the crowd. So the safest way to disperse a violent crowd, I mean, understand this is a deadly force situation. We're being shot at, and it's not only dangerous to us, but it's dangerous to the people that aren't shooting, the people that are in the crowd and in the neighborhood and, you know, in the businesses and so forth. So that has to be addressed. Once gunfire starts, it has to be addressed. And there's the safest way to do that is with tear gas. It's deployed, it's short-acting, but it is extremely effective in dispersing the crowd. Now, nobody has ever been killed in the United States using the type of tear gas, you know, as a cause of death ever in the United States. So it was safe, but it looked horrible. It just looks bad when, you know, seemingly, you're not hearing the gunfire when you're showing these images, when a large group of people are just filled up with the street and you have officers with riot gear, protective gear, because they're under fire.
You say police officers are being shot at? Was anybody actually shot by a protester?
The night that after I resigned, two police officers were shot on my police station parking lot. We had another officer, Ferguson officer, shot during the months of the riots. And but the night of the grand jury decision, as I said, they recovered the next day 3,000 spent shell casings. Hmm. And the gunfire was normal during the riots.
Now, you said that there was the media coverage kind of depicted the police department in a negative way. Didn't it vary according to who was reporting? I would assume that the local news media covered it a little differently than CNN did, and Fox covered it a little differently than either of those two.
Oh, sure, they did. And some of them, you know, where you have pundits, you know, they have, you know, their audience and their take and their view, and they mold it into that particular view. The local, most of the local press, you know, the reporters have been around a while, knew me. I was a captain with the county police department. I flew the helicopter and ran the SWAT team, and the last 12 years there, I ran a large multi-jurisdictional drug task force. So I was known to them when I took the job at Ferguson in 2010. So the local media had a better insight into Ferguson, you know, as the community that it was, and me as the law enforcement official that they've known for years. So yeah, there was a different take on state or on national and local media. Sure.
Why did you have officers remove their name tags? Is that even legal?
Oh, of course it's legal. I mean, the DOJ told us it wasn't. But what happened? And that used to be common practice up until then, when would be in riot situations. But in this day and age, now we have this social media where the people that were threatening the police officers would take pictures of their name tags, and then they'd go look them up on social media, and find them and then start threatening their families. So as a way to put a cap on that, that's why the name tags were removed, with a suggestion that their DSNs be put on the name tags, and that's where we were heading, so that there would be a badge number, basically,
we have as to opposed take, to a name. We have to take a little break, and we'll come back with more. My guest is Thomas Jackson, who is the former police chief of Ferguson, Missouri. He's written a book called Policing America, What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn from It. It's published by Skyhorse Publishing. We're back with Thomas Jackson, Ferguson, Missouri's former chief of police, who's written a book called Policing America, What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn from It. It is published by Skyhorse Publishing. Days after Michael Brown was shot, the Ferguson Police Department released a video of him shoving a store clerk in a convenience store. Was it your decision to release that video?
It was a group decision. We had we were being bombarded with freedom of information requests for everything. Some of them were where the purpose was to bog us down with busy work, because we'd get, you know, 1,000 email requests for the same stuff.
But was this relevant to the shooting?
It was requested. Now, and I'm surprised at the response to it, and I'm kind of surprised the way you're responding to it, seemingly, because it's something that was requested. And normally, when there's a video out there, the press wants it. You know, show us the video, give us the video, which is what they were doing to us. And I held it back for a time because, to be honest, I hadn't seen it. So when we started getting enough requests, we decided, let's release everything that we can release. And then, you know, then we can get back to work. So we didn't just release that videotape. We released Karen's name. We released, we were under pressure from DOJ to do that. We released the timeline of the shooting and everything that we had that that wasn't relative to the county's investigation. So, you know, I had reporters in my office, you know, demanding that videotape. So ultimately what we did is we made packets for all the press outlets that were there. And there was a bunch of documents that we had requests for in that. And one of them was that video.
Well, but the reason I ask is because it is not really connected with what happened. And yet many people saw it as a way of the police department kind of excusing its action. Michael Brown pushed this guy. He's not a good guy himself. And maybe that's the reason he wound up dying here.
No, that wasn't a thought there. I don't know where stuff like that comes from. It's a foreign concept to me. We were under siege at that point and being bombarded with, you know, things, not just projectiles, but all these requests. And, you know, we had to put staff on just to fulfill them, because when you get an FOI request, you're required to respond to it within, I think, 36 hours, as I recall. And it was longer than that we held that stuff back. But ultimately, we were going to have to release everything that was being requested, unless it was part of the grand jury process, and this wasn't.
When did people start calling for your resignation? Senator Claire McCaskill, didn't she call you about that?
Yeah, she called me, and she said, yeah, you know, Tom, you haven't done anything wrong, but you need to step down so we can start over with a clean slate. And I disagreed totally with that, because I thought, you know, putting somebody new in the middle of a riot who didn't know his people and didn't know the community would be very counterproductive. As it was, I did not lose one police officer during the whole months of turmoil. We all stayed and supported our community, because ultimately it really didn't matter what Claire McCaskill wanted, and it didn't matter what the Attorney General wanted. I was hired by the citizens of Ferguson to be the police chief in Ferguson, and that was my responsibility. This became a national event, but to me, I was the police chief in Ferguson, period. And as long as they wanted me there, I was going to stay.
What kinds of promises did Chris Custer make to help Ferguson contingent on your resignation?
I can't remember specifically. You know, there was going to be money funneled in to help rebuild, and there was going to be, you know, some kind of job center and just various things that people were going to bring to the table. My thought on that was, if it's the right thing to do, then just do it. Just do it.
The Justice Department.
Ultimately, nothing happened.
Well, you could have been fired, of course.
No, I couldn't have.
You couldn't have been fired?
No, sir. We have in Missouri, there's a just cause law that protects police chiefs from being fired for political reasons.
Now, the Justice Department report on Ferguson revealed that, quote, the 67% of African Americans in Ferguson account for 93% of arrests made from 2012 to 2014. Why do you think that was the case?
Well, we've filed a Freedom of Information request with the Justice Department, actually a group called Truth Ferguson has, because those aren't our statistics. In the 3 months, three months before that report, or before the shooting happened, the University of Missouri did a study of Ferguson, a survey of all the community, and found, in all the services and everything the city did. And one of the things they found was that the police department specifically had a 76% good to excellent approval rating from the citizens, with another 20% as fair, which is far and away different from what the Justice Department reported. And our racial profiling disparity index, which is required to be kept in Missouri and many other states, in the time between when I started there and the shooting, we had dropped from 1.47 down to 1.31 as a disparity index, the lower being better, while the state average had gone up to 1.61. So the statistics the Justice Department used were foreign to us, and we told them so. They said they didn't like the statistics the state kept, so they brought in their own statistician.
So you're saying that the 93% African-American stop is not correct?
I don't know where they got those numbers. Those numbers do not match what the city had.
My guest is Thomas Jackson, former police chief of Ferguson, Missouri. He's written a book called Policing America, What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn From It. It's published by Skyhorse Publishing. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. What are the vehicle challenges you describe in your book?
It's interesting. There's a new book about the trial of Wyatt Earp and his brothers following the shootout of the OK Corral. One of the things they talk about is the cowboys, the gang in that town, would walk down the street blocking everybody and daring people to challenge them about it. We had that problem, as many places do, where young people just stand in the middle of the street blocking lanes of traffic and challenge people to, honk at them, and then sometimes they'd beat on their cars or make them give them money to pass. It's sort of like in New York City years ago, you had the squeegee people who would, kind of keep motorists from traveling in certain areas until they've paid. And it's a problem that just has to be addressed, because people complain about it. And people have the option of, letting traffic pass or being cited for blocking a roadway.
So they were ticketed?
Yes.
The DOJ report revealed that Ferguson's municipal court routinely issued warrants for people to be arrested and incarcerated for failing to timely pay related fines and fees. Did you notice that disparity in arrest reports?
No, as far as the court's concerned, when you fail to appear in court, that's essentially contempt of court, and that's a judge's prerogative to issue a warrant. We had, if warrants were issued against people, an amnesty program that we participated in with other courts in other cities in the area, where folks, if they had a warrant, they could come in and set a new court date and have their warrant recalled. So we had those things as well. And we also had a very extensive community service program that was actually, it was a public-private partnership that funded it as an alternative to fines, where people could do community service.
Now, civil asset forfeitures contributed to 23% of the Ferguson Police Department's general fund. And from the DOJ report in 2011, the police chief, that would be you, reported that fines in the last month, quote, beat our next biggest month in the last 4 years by over $17,000. And the city manager responded, wonderful. Did you see fines and fees as a way to pay for the police force's budget?
No, absolutely not. The police department's budget was part of general revenue. And that's another thing the DOJ report did, is they framed things in ways that made them look like, you know, a prosecutor's brief. I regularly sent messages daily to the city manager discussing the previous day's activities. He would have also gotten messages from me that said, we seized a record number of illegal weapons this month. And he would have responded, that's fantastic. And, you know, we broke up a burglary ring. We broke up a copper theft ring. We broke up a car clotting ring. So what they did is they took things that looked bad and put them in that report. And if you read that report, there's nothing exculpatory in it. I sent them the University of Missouri report I talked about. I sent that to them three times. They finally told me they weren't going to use it. And the reason being that it painted us in a positive light.
Is this also untrue? Ferguson issued expensive fines for minor offenses. For example, $531 for high grass and weeds in a yard, $777 for resisting arrest, $792 for failure to comply with a police officer. The fine amounts were above regional averages for many offenses, and failing to provide proof of insurance cost $375 in Ferguson, more than double the median in other municipal courts in the region. Were you aware of those excessive fines?
I'm not even sure that they're true, but I know I had seen the fine structure. Again, that's the courts. I'd seen the fine structure, and they were not that high. They were nowhere near that. So, again, this is all stuff that we're requesting from DOJ to tell us where they got their numbers.
So there wasn't a problem with civil asset forfeiture in Ferguson?
I don't even know what that means. The only asset forfeiture that I was aware of in the police department was, you know, the federal asset sharing funds, which we had a detective assigned to the drug task force that I used to run. And when there's a federal asset seizure, participating communities can get some of that to be used exclusively for law enforcement purposes, such as equipment and training.
Didn't you make your officers receive special training? What did that involve?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do, there's a program in the academy here, and I think it's a nationwide program as well, that trains people to deal with people in crisis and with mentally disturbed folks, and it's a two-week program, so it takes a while. But one of my goals was to have everybody trained in that program, and also we had two of our officers were trained and actually taught at the area police academies, taught various courses in understanding cultures and racial profiling and things like that.
Had you ever hear officers use racial epithets in person or in texts? Do you believe that your officers understood the Fourth Amendment constitutional rights that citizens have against lawful search and seizure?
Of course, yeah. That's part of ongoing training and updated case law. No, we wouldn't had we known about any racial things like that. That's not absolutely not tolerated.
Are officers trained to arrest someone for not handing over identification?
It depends on if they are charged with a crime. For example, if you're pulled over for speeding, for example, the officer is going to ask you for your license or identification. You may not have that with you, or you may refuse. But if the officer can't identify you, you know, to issue a summons, then you could be brought in to be identified in the station, yeah.
Do you think...
You know, all a citizen has to do is identify themselves.
Is an officer allowed to ask everyone in a car for ID?
No. Yeah.
Do you think that there are systemic problems that led to the Michael Brown shooting?
I think we have, I think we're seeing it play out on a regular basis that there's nationwide problems, you know, dealing with poverty and hopelessness and lack of education and jobs and racial divide. It's a national thing that's well in the forefront right now.
Well, the debate has come down to people who argue that there's a police bias against people of color on the one hand, and then there are others who say there's a bias by people of color against the police. This seems to be something, an intractable divide.
Well, and when it's framed like that, it makes it seem like everybody thinks the same way. There's a groupthink, and there's not. Everybody has different experiences. So, you know, somebody has a bad experience with a police officer and may taint the way they view law enforcement in general. But, you know, there's no national bias police against people of color. As a matter of fact, anywhere you go to any conference or nationwide, the police chiefs conference and so forth, it's a major topic is combating bias, even when it's not known, you know, an implicit type bias.
Do you have any ideas of what could be done to make the situation better? You've thought a lot about this, of course.
Oh, of course I have. And it really comes down to communities and face-to-face, you know, interaction with people. And I think as the black middle class is growing and more people are interacting with people who aren't like them, you know, that breaks down the barriers. You probably know that from your own experience. You know, as you're more time you spend with people who are different, the more you realize that they're the same. You know, you travel internationally and spend time in other countries, and you get that feeling. So I think it's just getting away from the, you know, they're not like us type of a feel, and having more integration, more interaction, more people living and working together and understanding that we're really all the same.
Thomas Jackson, thank you so much for being on our show. He is the former chief of police of Ferguson, Missouri, and he's written a book called Policing America, What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn from It. It's published by Skyhorse Publishing.